Good morning and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. With me in the studio this morning is Jennifer Belcher. She is from the state of Washington, and I'm going to actually ask her to tell you, our audience, a little bit about herself. But she's here as a speaker and trainer for a program the Alaska Women's Commission is presenting today called Making a Difference, a Primer for Women in Public Life. And this is going on as we speak at the Noel Wien Library, and, as I say, is a leadership seminar sponsored by the Alaska Women's Commission. Welcome, Jennifer.
Good morning, and welcome to you.
Would you tell us a little bit about your background?
Well,
how did you get into politics?
I had two routes into politics. First was that I have been a longtime public servant. I worked for state governments, both in my home state of West Virginia and my adopted state of Washington, and got interested in politics when I worked as an assistant to two different governors in Washington state. One was a liberal Republican male, the other was a conservative Democratic female. So I had the breadth of experience there that you can understand that came from those two different perspectives. And I began to get intrigued with politics because of the opportunity to see it at that high a level of operation. The second thing that got me interested in politics, and probably the thing that caused me to run for office, was interest in the women's movement. I started my career as a secretary many years ago and worked my way to a higher position in state government, and as a secretary often felt the brunt of sexism. So I began to work in an organization called the National Women's Political Caucus, and the efforts that we put forth were to get women elected to office so that they could have an impact on public policy. And after spending about 10 years involved in that organization, I decided to run for office myself.
That organization is, in fact, has a chapter in Alaska, most active in Anchorage, and some of us are members from other communities, mm-hmm. but the only ongoing group that meets regularly is the Anchorage group. Would you tell the audience a little bit about that group and how it started and what their goals
are? The National Women's Political Caucus was started in 1971 by a group of feminists from all over the country, and their first meeting was held in Washington, D.C. They formed a bipartisan group. The group supports both Republican and Democratic women, which makes it a unique political organization. And their primary function is to get women elected to office. And they do sponsorships of workshops, training programs to teach women how to run for office. They have a wonderful program called See How She Runs that teaches women how to get involved in the political process. They do endorsements of candidates and then publish the record of that interview and that endorsement to the public so that women in general can understand which candidates are good on women's issues. They do a lot of things to teach women how to get involved in lobbying or volunteering in campaigns. So they're an organization that seeks to educate women and get them involved in the public policy-making process.
But not with a particular political point of view.
No, their issues are feminist issues, and they have only four issues that qualify you or disqualify you as an approved candidate for NWPC, and that those issues are the Equal Rights Amendment, the right to choose as far as reproductive freedom is concerned, public policy relating to daycare, and comparable worth pay equity issues.
Very good. And you got involved with them when you were still a secretary working for state government?
Yes.
And they encouraged you in your career laddering?
Well, I taught some of the classes for about 10 years. I taught other women how to be involved in the political process and didn't really see myself as a potential office holder or candidate for a number of years, and began to make many, many contacts in the community and do all of the things that candidates are supposed to be doing. And as I emerged as a leader and influential person in my own community, then I became a target for persons who were looking for good candidates. And so I was recruited to run for office then. Ran for the legislature first in 1982. And I'm just getting ready to campaign for my third term in office.
So a successful candidate.
Yes.
Successful the first time.
Yes. I ran against an incumbent, was outspent 2-1, and still managed to defeat him.
Yay.
I think so.
What seem to be the main barriers that prevent women from seeing themselves as candidates or from being more involved in the political process?
Well, I think the very first thing that prevents us is our societal attitude towards women's involvement. We still are a very backward nation in many ways as it relates to encouraging women into the public policy arena. We don't appoint women to public office when there is an appointment process. We don't allow women into Rotaries and Kiwanis Clubs and Lions Clubs and all of those kinds of clubs where most elected leaders begin their careers. We also have a problem with identity. We grow up in a society that teaches many women to feel inferior or to feel less confident about their abilities. We suffer from tremendous sexism in our society. So all of those things combined, I think, cause women not to see themselves as candidates. We're conditioned in many ways to see ourselves as the supporters of others. That's often painted as our kind of natural role, both in the work field and in public policy. And so we tend to be more the people who lick the stamps and fold the letters and stuff the envelopes than to be those persons who run for office. And it's only with groups such as the National Women's Education Fund, which is the other sponsor of the workshop today, and the National Women's Political Caucus, that women have begun to change their attitude about themselves.
It seems a bit immodest to run for office. Do you think that's...
I think that's one of the things that women have to deal with when they decide to run for office. It's very difficult to go out and say, I am the best candidate for this office. Please vote for me. And it's, I think, even more difficult if you're female, because we've been trained to be modest and ladylike. And it's not modest and ladylike to go about spouting off about your good attributes. So it's very difficult for women to do that.
You can't run successfully unless you're willing to sort of brag on yourself a
bit. And you have to be willing to state your best qualities for the voters and to state them very clearly. When I ran the first time, I said, I am the best candidate for this job, and here's why. And I think that it was that message, in large part, that got me elected over an incumbent. And you have to be willing to do that. And even when women do it, we still do it very modestly because we're not used to doing what we consider bragging.
Did you go to the training camp that helps you get an election together or
I did. Get a campaign together? I attended a number of training programs over the years, training programs put on by the Women's Political Caucus in my state. And then the party that I selected to run as a candidate from also puts on workshops, and I attended that. And over the years, I've attended a number of campaign how-to workshops. Last year, I attended the National Women's Political Caucus National Convention workshop, and you pick up new pointers all the time. It's a really effective way of learning how to run for office. One of the other barriers that women have is being able to raise money to run for office. Campaigns cost a lot of money, and in today's media world, campaigns cost even more. And women are still not seen as good political risks, and so a lot of donors don't like to make contributions to women candidates, and women don't like to ask for money. And so it makes it very difficult for us to raise the kind of money to compete successfully.
And very often don't have access to the money. Their
yes.
friends and colleagues are not the ones who are controllers of the purse strings.
Yes.
Also, something that I've seen in our communities, women aren't necessarily accustomed to contributing to political campaigns.
Yes.
So
one of my favorite stories about that is a Geraldine Ferraro story that I heard her tell many, many years ago, long before she became a vice presidential candidate. And that was that she had spent the day with a friend of hers who was involved in a campaign for a woman who was running for office. And the friend kept encouraging her to support this woman candidate. And Geraldine was reluctant to do so because she'd never been involved in politics. And she finally decided she would. And she got so enthusiastic about the candidate that she decided to make a contribution. So she wrote out a check for $50. And then she worried the rest of the day about going home and telling her husband that she had made this unilateral decision to spend $50 on a campaign when her husband didn't know who the candidate was. And she said she worried all the way home, and when she went in the front door, she met her husband, and she said, I have to tell you something. And he said, well, I have something to tell you, too. And she was nervous, so she said, well, you go first. And he said, well, I decided to endorse a candidate for office today, and I wrote out a check for $1,000. And she said that was her first political click, that she'd been worried all day about writing a $50 check, and he had no compunction at all about writing a $1,000 check.
Did it happen to be the same candidate?
No, they were different candidates.
In the same race?
Not in the same race. No, luckily.
At least they hadn't canceled each other
out. That could have created some real problems.
when you look at the demographics going way back, I think that the women who were involved in the suffrage movement in the early part of this century really believed that women acquiring the vote would make the difference in our own in being represented, mm-hmm. That we would vote from a woman's perspective, and that did not materialize. In fact, until very recently, women largely, there are polls that mm-hmm. were taken and studies that have been done that demonstrate this, have voted either in the tradition of their own family, which was determined by their father, we've always been a Republican family, mm-hmm. or we've always been good Democrats, or as their husband voted. Is that changing? There was a lot of publicity about the gender gap, especially when Geraldine was running, and it didn't seem to materialize to the extent that it was hoped.
I think it's changing to a slight degree. It's an interesting discussion because I think it's both positive and negative. It's almost insulting to think that women would vote as a bloc simply because they're women, because that says we have no ability to think individually and be individual people. And yet there are obvious positives to controlling a large bloc of voters. So for many, many years, there have been people who've tried to get women to vote as a bloc. And it's interesting when you look at the statistics of women voters. There are more women registered to vote than there are men. There are more women who vote consistently than there are men. And yet, as a bloc, women are harder to predict than men. And I think partly that says one thing. It says that we've been conditioned in our society as women to compete with one another. We are taught consciously and subconsciously from a very early age to be competitive with other women. We compete for the best jobs because there are too many women who want the few jobs that are allocated for women. We compete with each other to get the best man because for many, many years, having the best man has been our security, our source of stability in our lives. And so we've been taught a kind of competition that makes us, I think, automatically reject the idea of voting as a bloc. And so when that has been suggested, a lot of women who might otherwise listen to their women friends and sisters about how to vote have consciously or subconsciously rejected the idea. But I think the biggest part of all of that is that it's just difficult for anyone to expect that women are going to vote differently simply because they are women. There are some issues that are obviously more important to women or closer to us. The issue of reproductive freedom is something that I think women certainly have more, not more interest in, but they have a greater stake in than men do. And so I think you'll tend to find women who will agree on that issue at times. The issues related to home and family and children have always been considered more women's issues than men's issues. That's been both positive and negative for us. It's meant in many cases that those issues didn't get much attention in public policy. And now we're beginning to find that as more and more men and women separate and there are many single fathers, we're having more attention placed on issues that relate to children and families. So I think that you'll find that women don't tend to vote as a bloc, but there are certain women who are becoming more aware of the power they wield if they vote as a bloc. And those women tend to be politically active and they do vote together.
Yeah, that's one of the things we have in common, our gender, but in fact we are from very different economic strata in the mm-hmm. society. We have different concerns, different levels of education, and so on. So you really would expect that there would be a great difference that
yes.
way, depending on our perspective, where we're living, what issues are important.
Yes. It's interesting to me that people even articulate the fact that they expect women to vote as a bloc when you never or you rarely hear it articulated that men should vote as a bloc. And yet men have the same things in common that women do with one another. So I think it's an interesting phenomenon from all perspectives that we're expected to be more cattle-like and vote as a group than we've ever expected of men.
I hadn't thought of that in that way, except I suppose it comes from the idea that there are some things that we are really striving for, equality in the society, mm-hmm. for example, and that those issues, because on some level they are oppressive, might
yes.
become the preeminent issue that would concern us.
Yes. And I think from that point of view, that's when you see women voting together, is those women who recognize the oppression and feel oppressed are often the women who will stick together and vote for candidates who will, if for lack of a better term, who will lift their oppression. And so we do see women sometimes voting together when that's the case. I expect our foremothers looked at the suffrage movement and thought that that would be the great bond that would bring us all together. And it was for many, many women, but it wasn't for all women because not all women had the same kinds of needs or the same expectations out of that movement.
We've just passed Women's History Month, and so there's been some attention on that. It's amazing to me that sort of scant 60 years ago, women were really thrown in jail and punished for expressing a desire to have the vote. We've certainly come a long way when you view it in that kind of historical perspective.
It's really incredible when you look at some of that history. I think one of the unfortunate things is that that history is not a part of our normal curriculum in schools. And so most women and most young women are unaware of that part of their history. And it's really sad because there's a lot of history there, and there are a lot of things that women should know about the suffering and the pain that went on in order for today's young women to have the kinds of rights that they do.
There has been some criticism of trying to divide that history out, have a Black History Month, mm-hmm. a Women's History Month, and so on, that history should be history. And I guess we would both concur, except that we would like all of that other information
yes.
put in the regular curriculum
yes.
and mainstreamed, which is the notion of the Women's History Project out of Santa Rosa, is that it should be mainstreamed into the curriculum.
It'll be wonderful when we reach a point in our society where we no longer need special treatment for minority groups. Unfortunately, that's not the case at this point. And as long as history is still written from a white male perspective, it obviously leaves out a lot of other history that needs to be included. And at the present, the only way to capture that is through special histories. And I'm really anxious for us to reach a time when we can be included in the mainstream and be considered part of the mainstream. We're just not there yet.
Even when it's just a minor paragraph, because
sure.
our participation was limited a few years ago, and there maybe wasn't as much to say about it,
mm-hmm.
and certainly not as well documented as it is.
But they're
today.
Finding some very interesting diaries from early women. They're finding a lot of history really was captured. It just wasn't captured in the normal process.
Right, the normal major documents
right.
of state
right.
and government and economic trading, which is the normal way. Back to the National Women's Political Caucus. Their desire is to train women to run for political office, and they, I will repeat again for our audience, are not partisan. It's not that it's Republican or Democrat, but
mm-hmm.
just to get women to participate mm-hmm. In the way that they are promoting their own candidacies and supporting other women candidates. Why is that important? What benefit will that be?
Well, I think the greatest benefit and the most obvious is that women do bring a different perspective to public policy than men do, just because we are women, because of the role that we have played in society to this point. We have a very different perspective on children and family issues than men do, because of the role we've played in children and family lives. We have a different perspective on world peace because of mothering the sons who've gone off to die in world wars. We have different perspectives that are very valuable and are necessary if we're to continue to grow and develop as a society. So the very first benefit is just bringing that perspective to the public policymaking arena. I think a second benefit is that we will see a change in priorities in at least some areas when we have more women in elective office. Interestingly, we have seen that in the legislatures where there are many, many women representatives. The emphasis changes, and there is much more attention paid to issues that are considered to be traditionally female issues. And we're finding more concern about children's programs, which, when you think about it, it's amazing that we've gone so many years without paying attention to children's programs, because allowing children's programs to suffer means that as states we pay for bigger prisons, we pay for welfare costs, and all of those kinds of things that are long-term impacts of ignoring children's problems. So it's amazing that we haven't done a better job of that in the past.
But if we go back not too long ago, say to the 50s, where we have a sort of traditional father knows best
mm-hmm.
Image of the father out being the main breadwinner and concerned with the world of commerce and bringing the family a living, and certainly I would agree in the 1950s even that it didn't describe everyone, but it certainly described more families than it mm-hmm. does now. We're now looking at a time when it describes about 17% of the families where they have a male breadwinner, a female mother and homemaker in the home with children
mm-hmm.
in residence, and that's not even close to a majority of our families. But when that was the perspective, it makes some sense that the issues of women's and children's needs might not have been primary in our legislature's minds.
Well, I'm not sure I'd agree it makes sense. I think it's obvious that that was the case, and it probably was could have been expected that that would be the case. But any time that we neglect a certain segment of society or their concerns, we end up paying a price in future years, and that's precisely what happened to us in those years. We, in many cases, because those were issues that only women were concerned with, we relegated those to a lower priority in our society, and I think as a result we have some very serious problems in our society that we're dealing with now. The problem of child abuse is a good example. We have not dealt with child abuse as a society, and I think in many instances it's because it was not considered an important enough issue to deal with. It was something that men didn't have to deal with, even though many times men were the abusers. So we paid a price for pretending that one segment of our society was okay and was happy as it was. It's interesting when you get women involved in public office. You have a lot of changes that occur as a result of that. The role modeling is amazing. Right now, we have young boys and girls who have role models of either sex that they can follow. The change that dictates then is that we no longer sex segregate jobs to the extent that we did at, say, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the issue of comparable worth and pay equity is an issue that comes very directly out of sex segregating jobs in our society. So I think that we have a lot to gain by having equal representation in public life in our society.
Now, when I first went to New York after I finished college, there was help wanted male and female. And
yes,
there we were not, I'm not talking about jobs like firemen, which required a lot of physical strength. I'm talking about being the assistant manager in a shoe store, which had more women's shoes than it did men's.
Yes.
But that was not considered, management positions mm-hmm. were not routinely considered acceptable positions for women.
At that point, we were a very patriarchal society, and decision-making was definitely considered a male dominion. And there was not, you would probably have found very few positions in management anywhere in the country where women were accepted. They were the exception rather than the rule because they were not supposed to be key decision-makers.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Belcher. She's a state representative from the state of Washington, and she's in town doing a presentation for a conference called Making a Difference, a Primer for Women in Public Life. Let me ask you about the comparable worth experience in Washington State. We've had a job reclassification study done recently, just completed recently by the state of Alaska, and now we're looking at how we might fund that job reclassification, which it appears is going to be somewhat expensive because there are traditional women's positions which are, according to the study, underfunded. And we are also, as you know, looking at a declining oil revenue picture. Could you share with our audience a little bit about the Washington State experience with...
Well, I can give you a couple of quick words of advice. Don't follow our pattern because you could end up in more trouble than you ever want. Washington State began the question of comparable worth or began the search for comparable worth in 1974. We were the first state to take a look at that issue, and in fact the term was coined by a consultant that did a study for the state of Washington. I happened to have been a staff person in the governor's office when the study was done and was the governor's liaison for women, so I was involved in the original study.
And this was Governor Dixie Lee Ray?
No, this was Governor Daniel J.
Okay.
Evans. And the study was done at the request of the labor union that represented state employees and a number of women's groups, and they approached the governor and suggested that they had reason to believe that women state employees were being paid less than male state employees, even though they might have comparable jobs, not similar jobs, but comparable jobs in their requirements, simply because they were women.
And could I interrupt here and let's really define this? I think that there is some confusion about this, and I can't assume that all of our audience has equal knowledge. You just define comparable worth.
Well, very simply, comparable worth is a shortened version of the phrase comparable salaries or comparable pay for jobs of comparable worth. And it's based on a point factor analysis of a job. Currently, when an employer wants to pay someone for doing a job, they look at such factors as how much experience the person has, what kind of education and training the person has, what actual level of decision-making the person will hold, how much responsibility they'll have for other people and for managing money, those kinds of things. And based on a lot of those factors, whatever is most important to the employer settles on a salary for that job and says, this is what that job is worth. What we've found is that traditionally, we've had two problems. One is that women have been siphoned off and segregated into jobs that didn't involve much responsibility. They've been the support kinds of workers. And second, that we have a built-in bias when large numbers of women do a job. We tend to find the value attached to that job is less than if it were done by males.
The status is lower simply because it is done by women.
Yes, yes. And we have many, many instances where a job classification was traditionally male, and as women entered that job classification in greater numbers and in fact became the majority of those job holders, the salary declined. So it's not something that you can deny. It's there, and it's been studied many, many times and documented many, many times. In Washington State, when we decided to do the study, we selected job classifications that were predominantly male and some that were predominantly female because we wanted to make a gender comparison when we had finished. But at that point, all the jobs were treated exactly the same, and there was no identification of whether you were looking at a male job or a female job. The state of Washington selected four factors that they wanted to pay their employees for. One was experience and training. One was mental responsibility or the demands of the job, decision-making-wise. Another was level of responsibility for budget and personnel. And the fourth was working conditions, because we traditionally pay more if the working conditions are very negative. Each job was analyzed against those four factors, how much of each factor is present, and was given a value based on so many points for each of those four factors. Once all the jobs were totaled up, then you could make comparisons of one job to another. What we found was jobs with, say, 100 points in value, those that were held by men were paid about 20% more than those paid by women. And so in 1974, when the study was completed, the governor's office tried to decide what they wanted to do with that information. And as you can imagine, in 1974, 12 years ago, that was a very controversial issue. And it was not something you just said, well, okay, we're going to fix it, because there was a lot of question as to whether or not the data was accurate. So in Washington State, we restudied several times. We analyzed additional job classifications. We kept the studies going for a number of years. And finally, in 1981, the Federation of State Employees, which was the union that had originally brought the lawsuit, had originally asked for the study, brought a lawsuit against the state because they felt the state was dragging its feet after all those years. In 1983, our legislature passed a law that said, from here on out, the public policy of the state of Washington will be that we will pay comparable salaries for jobs of comparable worth. In other words, 200-point value jobs all get the same pay, no matter whether they're men or women that hold them. And we have been trying to resolve that issue since 1983. It so happened that also in 1983, the lawsuit was heard. The state of Washington lost the first round of the lawsuit, was found guilty of discrimination by a federal judge, and we were ordered to pay to instantly close the pay gap and to pay back wages as a penalty. So we began a kind of a lawsuit mentality in Washington State. The lawsuit was appealed and counter-appealed, and we went through some pretty incredible footwork at that point. Last session of the legislature, the state and the union reached a negotiated settlement, and we have now adopted a still controversial settlement agreement to the lawsuit that, in essence, will close the pay gap by 1993. So we have 8 years to complete that equalization process. And it's estimated that it will cost us about $500 million when we're finished with it. So you can imagine it's fairly controversial. We have just last week had a challenge entered in our federal court against the settlement, so we're not finished with it yet. But the first money will begin to go into paychecks the 25th of April.
So it's going to be incremental between now and 93?
Yes. We'll put a large amount of money in this biennium, $45 million this biennium, by June 30th of 1987. And then after that, every year we'll add $10 million to the salaries in order to reach that equalization by 1993.
Is that a large part of Washington State budget? I mean, is that going to be
really
felt?
That's a large piece of money for us. Our budget is about 9 $1.2 billion for every 2 years. And so $500 million is a significant piece of money for us. For us, because we're doing it incrementally, we don't expect to feel a real pinch from it. We allocated the $45 million last year and held it in case we could get a negotiated settlement. So that piece is already there. And $10 million out of a $10 billion budget is not that great a chunk. So it's not going to pose tax increase problems for us or budget cuts or anything else.
This issue really seems to hit home emotionally to a lot of people. A lot of people really react to this issue very personally.
It questions the value we have placed on men in our society. And when you think about it, that's a tremendously personal kind of challenge. When we had affirmative action, we never questioned men's value. We simply said, if men and women are doing exactly the same work, we have to pay them the same. So equal pay for equal work and affirmative action programs were not the same kind of challenge. What Comparable Worth says is that, in essence, we have been either overvaluing male work in our society or undervaluing female work. You can take your choice. And that is a real challenge to people's egos. So it's been much harder to win, and it's been much more emotional a battle.
The argument of many is that we need the free market.
Yes.
Enter the free market.
Yes.
To find the level of salary, and that if people will work for less, then that's what the job is worth. What is
Well, I love that argument. That's my very favorite argument against Comparable Worth, because it's so silly. In this country, the free market system exists only in theory and in textbooks. We do not have a free market system in this country and haven't had for many, many years, if ever. And I can cite you numerous examples of that. Look at what we do to the free trade market. Look at the subsidies we provide for agricultural products. We have millions of bushels of wheat rotting in piles all over this country because we don't want to put that much wheat out in the market because it would lower the price of wheat. We have subsidies for milk. We have subsidies for tobacco. We do all kinds of things in order to artificially inflate the price of certain goods in the market, even though the supply of those goods is overwhelming. In the job market, we have gone away from the free market system many, many times. The first good example of that is collective bargaining. Collective bargaining is a means for setting salaries that does not pay attention to what the market or the supply of people is in the marketplace. We don't pay truck drivers a certain wage because there are so few truck drivers. We pay them that because they've gotten together, they've bargained, and they have withheld their labor if they didn't get the price they wanted. So we have tampered with the free market in a number of ways. We also have said as a society that we're not willing to accept certain what we call devious practices of pay simply because we could take advantage of people who are desperate for employment. We have said, for instance, that we have a minimum wage in this country, and that even though you could probably find a number of people right now who would work for less than minimum wage, most jobs are required to pay minimum wage. We also adopted child labor laws many years ago for the same reason. There are many, many children who could be forced into labor and were forced into labor for years in this country until society said, wait, we think education of our children is more important than their cheap labor, so we're not going to let you hire children anymore. So we have tampered with that free market system in many, many ways. Some are even more blatant. There are two instances. One is an instance in Boston, where a group of employers of clerical people was caught meeting on an annual basis and setting salaries jointly, even though that's against the law, in order to keep the salaries of clerical people in the Boston area artificially low. The same thing was occurring in Denver with hospital administrators. And those nurses took hospital administrators to court and won because the administrators were jointly setting salaries for the nurses to keep those salaries low. We have not had a free market system in this country forever, as far as I know. And so now to say that we must impose one in order to keep women's wages low seems really ridiculous to me.
We have a very distressing divorce rate in this country, and the statistics are quoted frequently in Time and Newsweek and almost any magazine that you'll pick up, that we are witnessing now the feminization of poverty. We have 2/3 of those people who are living at or below the poverty level are women. They are single heads of household, and they are taking care of children. Is that a good argument for comparable worth?
Well, I think it certainly is a good argument for comparable worth. We have a real problem in this society with poverty. And as you said, two-thirds of the poverty stricken in this country now are women and children. And it's expected that if nothing changes, virtually all of the poverty people will be women and children by the year 2000. So we have a very severe problem. We are not seeing a change in the divorce statistics or the choices that women are making to live alone. So I don't think it's realistic to think that women are going to go back to being a part of a two-person family where they are the subservient or the supporting person. I don't think that's realistic. So the alternative is to provide some kind of a living wage and to recognize the value of the work that women are contributing to our society. I don't think we've done that. We haven't recognized the value of women's labor. We've put an artificially low value on that labor. We haven't changed that. And in fact, there are some people who believe that it's deliberate, that current administration practices at the national level are designed to force women back into the home. I recently read an article by Dr. Heidi Hartman, an economist with the National Science Foundation, and it was fascinating because she said that the programs of the current administration are designed to defeat equal pay practices, to do away with affirmative action, which would make greater job opportunities available to women, and to do away with the social programs, such as welfare, that support women, mostly women and children. And so the alternative is to go back to a traditional family situation. And I thought that was an interesting characterization of current administration policies. I don't think that anyone, until I had read her article at least, I don't think that anyone had really put all those pieces together in such an interesting way, that it's a deliberate policy to try to force a more traditional family relationship in our society.
My impression is that it's not an option for a lot of people.
It absolutely is not an option for a lot of people.
I think this is just an opinion, but I think most people would love to be part of a traditional family structure and, in fact, have a partner in child raising.
Yes. And I don't think that's limited to women. I think there are a lot of men who would love to have that situation.
Correct.
It'd be marvelous if we were a society that could sustain two persons on one income, but we aren't any longer. And as long as that's the case, then I think it's imperative that we begin to be honest in what we're doing at pay practices. You know, another interesting part of comparable worth that rarely gets discussed is to think about the positive impacts of paying people what they're worth. If you look at welfare in our society, 90% of the recipients of welfare are women and children. 90%. That's an incredible number. Two-thirds of the poverty stricken are women and children. If we were to pay women a comparable wage, most of those women could become self-supporting taxpayers, and the revenue that they would generate from paying tax dollars is incredible. We could probably cut the costs of welfare and a lot of those support systems at least in half, I would think.
Mm-hmm. There are more and more states, I think, adopting some kind of workfare policies where you are allowed to get some kind of supplemental payment mm-hmm. from the state or from the city to add to what might be really a non-living income. Mm-hmm. But if you look at even at minimum wage, a lot of the salaries that women get to pay rent, to pay for
yes.
food and clothe children, it simply isn't enough, and especially if child care
yes.
is part of that
child
equation.
Care is one of the biggest pieces of the equation, because as more and more women are on their own, if they're going to work and support themselves and be off of welfare, then they have to have child care, and the cost of child care is astronomical. You know, we're talking, in my state at least, an average of $200 per month per child. And if you have a couple of children and you make $800 or $900 a month, you've spent your entire budget on child care. So it's unrealistic to think that we're going to be able to support women without a living wage. We're either going to support them through subsidies, government subsidies, or we're going to allow them to support themselves by paying them an honest wage. That seems to me the latter is better for many reasons, including the fact that it builds self-esteem and allows people to feel good about themselves.
You said that the representation of women in the state legislature in Washington is quite high.
Yes, we have almost 25% of our legislature that's female. We, at one time, were the second highest in the country, and we lost that a couple of years ago in an election, and we're now number four.
We have 47% of our population are women, and we have 18% representation in our state legislature. So that is quite low. Well, certainly low.
Well, you're probably average for
most
states. You're probably average for most states. But certainly you have some room to grow. And that's what's so exciting about the workshop that we're doing. There are 75 women in this area who've indicated an interest in becoming politically active, either as candidates for office or as campaign managers for other women candidates. And that's really exciting because it says you have a chance to elect some obviously very good candidates if they're out this early getting prepared.
What kind of things are you going to cover? What kind of things are you going to teach them?
We're going to talk about, in general, what a good, successful campaign looks like. What are the things that you have to do and how do you do them? And then we're going to do some practicing to make it easier for women to learn to ask for a vote and to ask for money. So we're going to talk very specifically about raising money and about voter contact and asking for that vote. We're also going to hear from a panel of women who are successful themselves, either as elected women or career managers in government or campaign managers. So I think all in all, we'll have some good tips for women on how to get involved and how to run for office.
I think locally in Fairbanks, we've been very fortunate to have some very qualified and successful women candidates. We just recently elected a woman mayor, Juanita Helms, of the borough, and we've had women on the city council and in the borough, Sandra Stringer, prominent among them, and I think she's going to appear on that panel. And we've had a representative, a senator, Betty Fahrenkamp, who has been actually a senator for a long time. But we are not so lucky with our representation in the state house because we have all male representation at the moment. We have a number of women candidates running statewide at the moment, and that is nice because it is a real undertaking to run a statewide campaign.
Oh, I can imagine with the size of the area that people have to cover, it must be very difficult.
And we're talking some heavy financial demand there to run for office in Alaska. Are you involved with any election reform in the state of Washington? The cost of running for office seems to be just going up and up and up.
It's astronomical. We've tried in Washington to do some campaign reform. I don't know if Alaska has public disclosure, but in Washington we have a very strong public disclosure law and have had for a decade or more. And so that has helped tremendously. We have some pretty strict rules on campaign contributions and transfers of money, those kinds of things. But we still don't have a limit on the amount of money that can be contributed by an individual or an organization. And so that allows for an awful lot of expensive campaigning to go on. This last year, we had a bill before our House and Senate that would have limited campaign contributions. We were not successful in passing that, and Common Cause has developed an initiative that they're trying to get signatures for that would put the issue on the ballot this November. So there's a possibility that we will have an initiative before us in November that would require limited contributions.
Pat Schroeder was in Alaska last fall, speaking at a major convention down in Anchorage, and she said that she really feels that the women in national office, we are slipping, we are losing ground. Do you have any feeling as to why that should be?
Well, I think part of that has to be that women are concentrating now on state-level politics in large numbers. When I first got involved with the Women's Political Caucus, we concentrated almost entirely on congressional offices. We were trying so hard to get women in at the congressional level that we ignored our own legislatures. And then several years ago, the national organization did an about-face and decided that we had to build candidates from the grassroots level. We had to prepare women to run for those higher congressional offices. And so we started concentrating on state legislatures. And as a result, we have more than doubled the number of women legislators around this country in the last 10 years, which is a phenomenal change. I think that has meant, though, that we've sacrificed running women for the national office. It's interesting, though, because now we have a number of women who have served at the state level for over a decade who are beginning to be ready. And I think that in the next 2 to 4 years, you're going to see a tremendous change in the candidates at the national level. There's an interesting new Democratic organization that I know about. It's called Emily's List. Emily's List is an acronym for Early Money is Like Yeast. It causes things to rise.
Early money is like yeast.
Causes things to rise. And Emily's List is an organization of contributors for women candidates for the United States Senate. And it works like this. You're asked to become a member of Emily's List by donating an initial $100 and making a commitment to donate $100 to each of three candidates at some point during the next year when those candidates identify themselves as U.S. Senate candidates. And by doing that, they have managed to raise over $100,000 already this year for women candidates for the U.S. Senate. Now, that's going to make a difference in elections when we can begin to raise that kind of money. $100,000 is a drop in the bucket.
I was going to say,
for a senatorial race.
It is really a drop
in the
bucket.
But compared to what we've been able to raise in past years, it's tremendous. And we have the ability, by signing up more members to Emily's List, to raise millions of dollars by doing that, specifically targeted for U.S. Senate races.
I have in front of me the little flyer that is put out by the Alaska Women's Commission, and it gives the figures for Alaskan women in politics, and it includes the 47% of the state population are female. Our state legislature has 18% women. Our state boards and commissions has 38%, and I think we've been doing increasingly well in that category. More women are seeking appointment, and more women are being appointed.
And that's really good, because that's a stepping stone to running for political office.
We only have one congressman, and he is a man, so we don't have any people in any women in the United States Congress. We have 11% women mayors, but here's an interesting statistic. 53% of the school board members in the state of Alaska are women. And so that's a real good example of low-level grassroots participation, which in fact has a lot of impact on the society, what kind of decisions are made at a school board level.
It's also an interesting phenomenon that education is traditionally seen as a women's area. Again, it's an area of taking care of children. Most teachers are female, and so it's an area where women tend to be more easily elected than they are in other areas. It's an excellent stepping stone from there to higher elective office. One of the things we've not been good at is teaching women to make that next step. We tend to elect women to school boards or mayors or legislatures and then leave them there rather than teach them how to move on to the next level. And that's what we have to begin to do next.
It's quite a sacrifice, actually, of your personal time and family life to be a public office holder. How have you managed to juggle that?
Well, as well as the next person, probably not as well as I could. It is a very difficult and very time-consuming job to be a public official. I happen to have a very supportive husband who is used to not seeing me around a lot, and we try to make quality time out of the time that we have together. I also don't have children, and that makes it much easier for me. I am particularly sympathetic to the women office holders who do have family, who do have children, because it's a very difficult thing to accomplish, to do both. The legislature is a good example of the difficulties of doing that. Legislatures are generally in session for a specific period of time, and when you're in session, you're there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you have very few breaks to go home and take care of your family or be with your family. And then during the rest of the year, you still have a lot of duties, a lot of responsibilities. And in my case, I run for office every 2 years. Mm-hmm. So I get a campaign experience that takes what little time I have left. In addition to that, I have a management consulting business of my own that I try to do to make a living, because our legislative salary is not enough to live on. So it's a real juggling act to keep all of those balls in the air at the same time.
I interviewed Yvonne Brathwaite-Burke this year, and she said that her husband had to do a lot of the child care. Mm-hmm. They have a son, I believe, and she said, luckily he was willing to do that, but had he not been, she says, I simply couldn't have done it.
No, it probably would have been impossible. Interestingly, you see in public office, you see mostly women who have completed their child-rearing responsibilities. You'll see either women who are single or women who have completed their family obligations and have then decided they have time to do something else. And there are very few women who are married women with children or single women with children, because the constraints are just too difficult for us at this point.
We seem to be basing our success model on someone who has a real good support system, albeit silent, support system at home. And, you know, we have some movies out, Mr. Mom and so on. But really, to be successful, to put in the kind of hours that are required to be competitive up at the higher levels of business and elected office, we really seem to assume that there is someone at home doing all of the more mundane tasks.
Sure. We model our systems, our government systems, our business systems are still male-designed and male-oriented in our society, and they were all designed for a man who has a support system, both at the office and at home. And so you see job structures that don't allow much time off for child-rearing, that don't have much in the way of part-time employment. You see very few employers who provide daycare opportunities for working parents. You see legislatures that expect to go 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and have someone else provide the clean clothes and the cooking. And that is a model that works well for men in our society because men tend to have more support systems. It is not a model that works well either in politics or in business for women who don't have that support system. I think the more women we get into public office, the more likely we are to change the system so that we can accommodate other kinds of women and men. But until we get enough people in public office who have an understanding of those needs, it isn't going to change much.
In fact, it is a frequently cited reason for leaving public office by men is that they want to have more time with their family, mm-hmm. especially someone who runs successfully for several terms. They can take a look around and see that their kids are growing up without mm-hmm. them and that they don't even know these kids, or it's at least very difficult.
Yes.
So I think it's something that is a sort of growing awareness and perception of men in office. Also.
It is, and I think the more men, the divorce rate has had a positive impact in that respect because there are many, many single men now who are parents and who are learning to take care of children and family responsibilities on their own, and that's causing a new awareness among some men. And as that happens and we have greater numbers of single parents and greater numbers of single income earners out there on their own, we're bound to make some changes in our societal structures, and that can only be positive in my opinion.
As we take on the responsibility for certain tasks, we're aware of more of the ramifications that those mm-hmm. tasks have. Let me back up. State of Washington. Did we discuss how your legislature is slightly different now that there are more women represented?
Well, it's been interesting to me to watch. First of all, women tend to be different kinds of legislators than men do. Most women come to the legislature out of a concern for issues. If you look at the women who are in public office, many of them came through the League of Women Voters or the National Organization for Women or the Women's Political Caucus, but they came because they had issues they wanted to work on, things they wanted to achieve. Men tend to come to the legislature as a career move. It's something that will help them to achieve more in their business environment or gives them greater stature in the community or is a stepping stone to higher office. And so the two tend to take a different approach towards their legislative responsibilities. And I'm finding that in Washington State particularly, a lot of the women legislators are beginning to be known as very credible legislators because of the kind of work they do, the kinds of issues that they take on. Many of the major issues are now handled by women in our legislature. I'll give you, for instance, this past session, we passed a water quality bill that we had wrestled with for 2 years in the legislature, and it's designed to clean up the water pollution problems in Washington State, both with Puget Sound, which has some very significant water problems, and with the state's drinking water. And so that's an issue that would certainly not be considered a traditional women's issue, and yet it was a woman legislator, a freshman legislator in the House, who was able to put the bill together, who was able to reach the compromise between the House and the Senate that got the bill passed, and who undoubtedly will be the legislator who monitors how that bill is implemented. We find more and more women in positions like that in the legislature. And as a result, I find that we reach compromise more easily. I don't know if that's because maybe I believe all of that stuff I've been taught about how good women are at compromising, but it does seem to work that way. Women are more... seem to be easier to work out a compromise. It's easier for them to work with the other body or the warring factions and work out a compromise. And so we've seen a tremendous change in the way business gets done in our legislature. We also have the highest number of women in leadership in our legislature of any state in the union. We have approximately 50% of our leadership in the legislature is women. And that means committee chairs and actual leadership positions. So we're finding that women have an influence on both how the process is carried out and the issues that get priority attention. And that's been kind of nice.
the more women that there are, in fact, serving, I think the stereotypes start to fall, and they realize that women are not simply one or two issue people.
Yes.
Our own state senator, Betty Fahrenkamp, is very interested in natural resource issues. That's near and dear to her heart, as well as other issues. Mm-hmm. But she's certainly taken a front position on that, and it's not a traditional women's concern. And so I think just being there, some of the prior prejudices or expectations are being demonstrated to be not true.
Absolutely. And we're also forcing the male leadership to recognize that we don't all act the same and react the same. And that's been good for us, too, because there's a tremendous tendency to say, well, if one woman is a troublemaker, then obviously all women would be troublemakers. And so if one steps out in the wrong direction, none of you can have anything. And by the sheer numbers of women in the Washington legislature, we're beginning to force our own leadership to take notice of us and to treat us as individual members. And that's been very good.
And it's not to stereotype you by gender.
Yes. Yes, it's been wonderful.
Are you familiar with Carol Gilligan's work on the difference of moral development between young boys and young girls?
Not specifically.
At any rate, what she discusses is that we train our children from a very early age to solve problems in a different way, and that women are taught to cooperate, and young boys or girls are taught to cooperate and to seek some kind of compromise, and that young boys are taught to really be tough and to be assertive and aggressive and to win. And that assumes that there is a loser.
Yes.
So you seem to be saying that is being reflected in your work in the legislature.
I think that's true. I also, in my business, in my management consulting, I developed a program called Working With and For the Opposite Sex, which draws a lot on that kind of social conditioning to point out the different way that men and women do approach things. We've been conditioned to approach things differently, which is what you're saying. And that's absolutely true. And we have to change the conditioning. And one of the ways we do that is with sheer numbers. The more of us men have to deal with in a given set of circumstances, the more they will have to realize that we are not all the same and that we do react differently.
It has been my pleasure to have this hour of conversation with you. I've been speaking with Jennifer Belcher, who is a representative in the Washington, in the state of Washington government, and who's up here to do some work for the Alaska Women's Commission. And much of the work that the Alaska Women's Commission does is very excellent. It gives us some statistics, some information on the status of women in the state, and calls attention where there are great inequities. And I'm very pleased that they brought you up here and that the workshop is being so warmly received.
Good. So am I. It's my pleasure.
We have some sunshine, if not some warmth for you. So
yes. I'm looking forward to that after all the rain from Seattle.
Have you had a rainy winter?
We've had a very nice winter, very changeable, very cold and then very foggy and then very rainy, and then we've had the most beautiful spring weather. But today as I left, it was pouring rain.
Well, I've just come back from out east in the dogwoods and the azaleas and the cherry blossoms.
Yes.
In Washington, D.C., we're all in full bloom, and it was very disheartening for me to get off the plane to a gusty 20 below. Really made me pause.
Well, Washington State is all in bloom, too, and it's been really nice. We've had a beautiful spring, and everything is in bloom there. The tulips and the rhodies and everything are already out.
Well, I hope send some of that warm weather up and that this recent cold that we've been having will come to a speedy end here so we can get on with our spring. I hope you have a nice weekend. This has been Home Fires Radio Show. I've been your host, Patty Kostelic. Our executive producer is Carla Tanella. Have a very nice weekend.